This week, Maya and Luca join the police on some ride-alongs. And across the city, Adrian and Diane are representing a TV network who are looking for legal justification to run with a Me Too story about a popular actor. Adrian has to confront his own past behaviour with women. And not everything he learns about himself is anything he feels comfortable knowing. It's a night for the discovery of hidden secrets and politely waiting for a duck who has nowhere to be.
Sexual harassment is no longer the province of Me Too hashtags. It's being used politically.
Gather your legal briefs and get ready for a rumble. This is the Good Fight SBS Fan Podcast. It's our weekly discussion about the TV drama The Good Fight. We dive deep into the show with an exploration of the real-world stories that influence The Good Fight. My name is Dan Barrett. I'm an editor here at SBS on a TV site called The Guide. And joining me each and every week, it's SBS Life Deputy Editor Sarah Malik.
Hi, everyone.
Sarah, how are you doing this week?
I'm okay. I'm a bit tired. I just smashed because I'm just like, ugh.
Somebody had a birthday yesterday.
I have cake.
You brought cake for us?
I brought cake for you guys.
What sort of cake is it?
It's chocolate cake.
Oh my God. We're in. It's very exciting. Anyway, we're getting into a pretty fun episode of The Good Fight. There's a fair bit going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really the meatiest episode, but there's a lot of smaller stories that I think we could talk about throughout here.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with the Me Too stuff. I thought that was super interesting. Because it kind of showed the parallel world men and women inhabit when it comes to understanding this stuff. And even the so-called good guys can have a real cluelessness when it comes to the feelings of women. So I thought that was really interesting. So the storyline was basically a journalist has a Me Too story, two women coming forward against a high-profile actor. And so it's a firm's job to basically investigate the claims and see if the story can run or not.
You have a news story. It's yours to broadcast or not.
Yeah, unless it's defamatory.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves, okay?
I'm just more of a...
Okay, wait. Carter is our in-house counsel. He keeps us from doing anything stupid. Reddick Bozeman, you defend us if we end up doing anything stupid, so we all have a role here. And we have 7 hours to figure out whether to broadcast this story, so let's start.
So some interesting themes there, and I think what really struck me was the show kind of brought to light the kind of parallel world men and women inhabit when it comes to understanding this stuff and understanding women's feelings. So, you know, Adrian has to confront the fact that maybe in his own past he's, you know, not always acted fairly, or the way in which men kind of dominate positions of power and how that impacts the people around them in a way that they're not even aware of. So I think a lot of that unconscious stuff and how it impacts people is really interesting, because you can literally have parallel conversations with people where they don't actually understand how things operate and the impact that it has on the people, like people around them.
Yeah, and the power imbalance that can occur when you don't actually quite realize there is that level of power at play.
Hmm.
It was interesting the way they approached this story structure, purely because you got two things. You got the Adrian storyline, but you've also got the broader issue with the actual story of the week. So the story of the week has the actor who's being investigated in a Me Too type situation. And as one of the characters in the show says, this is part of the second wave of Me Too.
Mm.
But when I actually looked at the story itself, it became less about the Me Too situation and really about a lawyer who was trying to better himself. So he'd embedded himself in this legal conversation where he should have excused himself because of a conflict of interest. So
yep.
It became less about the actual Me Too story and that interesting, complicated, very gray area where a Me Too situation or any sort of large public shaming like that can be used for personal means. And I think that's a really interesting area that isn't really discussed that openly. And it'd be cool to see The Good Fight explore something happening there, okay, for whatever take they want to do on it. That'd be interesting. Instead, what they did, I thought, didn't really quite have that same gravitas.
Yeah, and I like the fact that they were kind of looking at the different motivations people have.
But they didn't really quite do it though. I thought it was a bit lacking.
I think they did address it because I think like they were talking about second wave and politically motivated, and that's kind of obscured this whole movement. And even though it's a thread and it might be like 0.1% of the whole thing, it's often used to undermine the whole concept. And so I like the fact that they were addressing it, but then they were actually showing how that's in a way used to undermine women's claims or women's experiences. So I like the fact they were like, okay, we just need to check this out. And then when they were actually talking to the women, like I think that the difficulty that they, the position they were in and the difficulties of the journalists in actually bringing that stuff to light and the power that they come up against was really emphasized. And I think that that was really important because I do feel like this becomes just like a Trojan horse again, like, oh, like this is being used in this way. And even though that might be one aspect of it, I think that it's often used to obscure the issue as a whole. And so I like the fact that the firm and the storyline kind of played with that issue and addressed it more and addressed the ambiguities around this issue. So that was, I think, very important.
I think it was more lip service. I don't think they actually did enough to flesh out the complicated aspects involved in it. So with something like, because I mean, you're saying that often it obscures, I actually don't think it obscures that much, which I think speaks to the success of the Me Too movement, in that, yes, there's often, if you look in any comments, and you never read the comments on anything, mm-hmm. it never ends well. But if you read the comments on any article, there'll always be people who start to create some sort of conspiracy aspect to things or try to bring in those other elements. And while they can certainly exist, I think that it's important to really understand the mechanisms in place to allow those conspiracies to exist. But also there's the other thing happening at the moment with a lot of social media networks under attack from, we'll say, foreign players, okay? And a lot of it's about amplifying Me Too and trying to create conspiracy where there isn't conspiracy. So I think it would be very worthwhile for a show like this to actually explore how those mechanisms can be in place to create the quote-unquote conspiracies and other reasonings for, you know, a genuine Me Too story to be overshadowed. Mm. I don't think it did it, which is why I'm hoping that they come back to it in a few weeks' time and really just go a bit further into it, because I think there's a lot of interesting stuff. But I think the actual valuable story here was, as you were saying it right at the beginning, the Adrian Bozeman storyline, where it's about him confronting the fact that he had a power imbalance with some students back when he was teaching law, like a decade or two previously. And it's really about the fact that he had a thing for one of his students, was giving her a lot more attention, and as a result, other women in the class felt they weren't really being given the attention of which, you know, was warranted. Now, there's two things to that. One, I don't think they did enough to really explain the relation dynamic between her and Liz to really understand exactly how it was that she felt personally threatened by it and how many students were involved. And maybe there's also some guy students in the class as well who aren't getting the attention because he's so focused on this one student. Mm. Okay, but I kind of liked that story wasn't so much a Me Too storyline as much as it was just saying, hey, look, you know, there are power imbalances that exist within a situation
like that. I think that one was more like, because at the end he was like, oh, you know, you were just basically because she was a star because of her father, because of connections. So I think that that was really interesting because it showed that there's so much in terms of success or moving forward or maneuvering your way. There are all these factors that seem really unfair, you know, and that people are motivated by things that are not always pure.
Yeah.
And I think
so,
that
I mean,
that
wasn't even just sexually motivated. It was pure career climbing motivated.
Yeah, he was literally just, it was basically just an ambition game. So
whether that was actually necessarily the case, or maybe it's kind of just getting that notch on his scoreboard to say, oh, well, you know, I had sex with like this respected...
It could be some kind of interconnected issue. But I think for me, it really kind of addressed the fact that it's like that get out moment, that feeling that you get when no one else gets it around you or being talked over or just those small ways, small humiliations like people of color or women experience when they are navigating the workplace or navigating school or navigating conversations where they're like, oh, they really don't get it. Like they really don't get it. And I think that that for me was this episode did that, you know, where he was like, oh, okay. Like I had to confront something that I didn't even see and I didn't ever even acknowledge or I don't even understand that it was something problematic. So that for me was real moment of validation. I was like, oh, I know what that feels like. I felt like that so many times where you're like, wow, they really just don't get it. Like they're not from that world or they just don't see how the world they operate privileges them and actually affects other people negatively.
Yeah, the one thing I'd like to have seen the show explore a little bit more there is you've got this woman who ended up becoming a journalist because she didn't want to stick through, you know, the legal studies because she'd been off-put by this one lecturer.
Hey, nothing wrong with becoming a journalist, by the way. How is that? Like, it just seems like it was this sad, sorry B option that she just had to go down, you know, at the risk of pursuing a dream.
Can you even imagine giving up law to become a journalist?
I know.
Sarah Malik.
Like, what a jolly alternate path that she had to like deign herself to go down. So,
law was your first degree?
Yes, it was. But that's just because I'm an ethnic person and we just have to have like five or six plans in place, you know? Like, you can't just do this thing that, you know, this low paid profession that is, you know, anyway.
Yeah. We've got to have a backup. What I thought was kind of interesting and the thing that I wish they'd explored a little bit more was that she was saying that because of this thing that has happened, she ended up not feeling as though she could continue through with law. But from my perspective from the outside, I don't really understand how just one lecturer can have that impact on her. Mm. And two, maybe what the gender balance is, if that's necessarily what was at play with this character, between other people in her class, like men who were in the class, who also weren't getting that level of attention that Liz was getting. And why it is that a lot of them probably went on to maintain careers in the law, whereas she felt that she couldn't. And I just kind of wish they'd explored that little area a bit more, just to give a bit more grounding as to why it was that she felt she couldn't. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if Adrian was just one of many lecturers of whom were giving her very similar runarounds for different types of reasons,
But I mean, it kind of just shows these things are not always like, it doesn't have to be something big.
Oh no, that kind of it's puts the little you, things that
yeah,
add
it's
up.
The little tiny things that like, you know, someone will just give you a motivating word or you'll see something or you'll develop a passion from a small seed or those things can close down by, you know, a teacher's remark. Like people talk about the things that their teacher said to them in high school and I'm just amazed how they just take it with them that, you know, you're bad at art or you're never going to get anywhere.
Yeah.
And they use that either as a point to prove or really use it as a way that that really kind of closed down something in them. So the things that people say.
I don't feel they got to that moment though. No. I feel that the show just kind of glossed over that slightly. And I appreciate that the overall message of what they were trying to say is certainly within the episode and that's cool. But when we're sitting down and we're writing down notes on the show, thinking about things that we want to talk about in this, those little aspects of things I think become magnified so much more than your just general viewer watching it on the couch. I think most people watching the show would have walked away from that scene going, totally get it. Adrian behaved that way. And as a result, she, you know, it sort of skewed her perceptions of what she wanted to do in the law. I think story achieved. But I mean, for me, when I'm gradually looking at the story, there's just like those bits of connective tissue that just aren't quite there.
I definitely feel like detail is important. Like to have an emotional resonance with a character, you need to play the scene out a little bit more. You need to kind of say, oh, okay, what was that person's emotional experience? Or what was that point for someone? But I think for me, it was just the dissonance that was interesting, how different people can come away from the same scene with a totally different emotional experience, depending on how they're positioned within that scene. That for me killed it. Like Adrian has one position being the teacher, Liz has another. She was like, it's like, I think a family where the favorite knows they're the favorite, you know, and everyone else is kind of, or the parents are not aware about how the way they behave affects the other children. I think that was powerful in that you can come away with totally different interpretations of the same event. And depending on your positioning in that scene or where you are placed in terms of power, that affects you in really different ways. So that for me was, I love that. I love the dissonance. It's like, they really just do not know. Like people just do not know how they behave and what impact it has on other people.
I actually take massive exceptions to what you said. Just in that I've always suspected I was the favorite, but I don't know for sure.
The favorite always knows they're the favorite, you know?
I can't be 100% certain.
And like, it's like you just know, you know?
I wasn't pretty enough for you.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. I was in the same class as Liz Reddick. You only had time for her.
Now, the other storyline that's taking place this week, we've got the ride-alongs that are happening with both Luca and Maya.
Maya Rendell.
Yes.
Let's go, put this on.
Is this a bulletproof vest?
No, it's a stab-proof vest. Protects you against knives and thrown ass.
Fun times.
Yeah. You've got Luca, of whom is having a very quiet night watching a duck go across the street very slowly.
I love that scene. I was like, that is the absurdity of life. That's what life feels like sometimes.
I don't feel they went far enough with the duck. I need to know about its motivation. No. So I thought that was very funny. I like the fact that that was really just a bit of a misdirect to throw you into the storyline of Luca with Colin's mum, of whom's had a few drinks.
Yeah.
And also, just sort of props for the show as well for having Andrea Martin as the guest star as the mother. I thought it was really great bringing her back into the show. She was a lot of fun. And then you've got the revelation where she actually tells Colin that she's pregnant at the end. I was thinking about you the entire time.
I was loving it. You know what a fan I am of the Luca and Colin storyline. You know, I dig them. You know, I'm just enjoying that whole setup. And oh my God, he is so in love with her, you know? And when he proposes at the end, okay, obviously she can't say yes, but when she tells him that she's pregnant, you can see his eyes light up. Like he's so happy, even though he's unable to process that moment because she springs it on him in a really awkward situation. Like, oh my God, Luca, can you please develop some kind of emotional skills? Like I can't handle this girl's complete, like, closed offness. Like, seriously, girl, like, see a therapist, get some work done on communication skills. Like, Colin's a good guy, you know? Like, he hasn't put a step wrong. And with Luca, she just closes off so easily. And I hope that she can open up to him, and I hope that they can, yeah, work things out.
Yeah. Luca's a character who she knows that she's the favourite. you've also got Maya, who's got the storyline this week of being in the complete counter storyline to what Luca has. Uh-huh. It's quite a night for Luca, really busy night for Maya, where she gets involved in street fights taking place.
Oh, God, she's out there. She's in the jungle.
But then she also goes to that guy's house and finds the dead body in there and sees the police, of whom are hiding the goods. Later to be revealed that the police weren't actually stealing goods, as Maya had believed, but rather it was just that they were trying to do one of their cop friends a solid by hiding some goods of which he'd given to, you know, a woman he was having an affair with, and they were planning on getting it to the wife to stop the embarrassment and the shame of, you know, this affair from getting out. And I thought that was kind of really interesting, and a very interesting way for the show to handle storylines regarding police corruption. Because I think the show from season one was very much an anti-police show to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And then this episode, it was really just pushing that idea that police work often actually involves a bit of human discretion as well. And while this show will certainly not be afraid to go into the realm of talking about the mistakes that police make, okay, and some of the bad attitudes and bad behaviors that underline that, there is also that idea that if you're following things completely to the book, sometimes you're not doing a service to society, to the community, and doing what they actually should be there doing, which is making judgment calls. And sometimes, and I appreciate there's a issue in this episode where the judgment call that's made is to a wealthy white woman. Okay, if she was a person of color, wealth or otherwise, it probably wouldn't have gone that way. And the show didn't really explore it. So it's a disconnect from what the show usually does, where they actually would explore that. But I'm willing to let it slide this week because they actually do usually explore it. So you can't expect that every week where they point out the injustices.
No, I think that's a really good point because they have built up the show around, you know, the police are not the good guys. And so this episode explored a lot of the nuances and the grays and the complexities around, you know, they're ready to catch them out. But even the police have to work within sometimes what's the decent thing to do or what's the good thing to do. And even if that puts them on the edge when it comes to the rules. So I think that that's a really good point. And that was a deliberate shift. And I don't know why they showed that aspect, like what purpose it served, but I definitely noticed that. And I think that's been a shift from what we've seen previously when it comes to looking at the police and the justice system.
This week on the show was kind of interesting in that there wasn't really one specific meaty legal issue that they were getting involved in. There were lots of little things. And the ones that I really wanted to tap on is, we've already discussed the Me Too, and I don't think there's much more we can really tap into there. But the ride-alongs I thought were kind of interesting, purely because there's nothing we can really discuss there, because I think the actual storyline with lawyers doing what I presume is pro bono work, but I don't really know for sure, it seemed like once a month a few lawyers go out and do these ride-alongs. Why are defense attorneys going along these ride-alongs? I don't understand.
Is it because they're junior and then they just think that would be a useful exercise?
Look, that's an entire possibility I hadn't really thought about. So the Justice Department, and I was doing some reading on this, regularly do have lawyers go out with the police for the exact reason as what you saw happen in this episode. They see what the police are up to and, you know, offer feedback, and they try to maintain the integrity of the legal structure there. So it just seems weird that you've got these private lawyers of whom are taking on that work. Yeah. I didn't quite understand that.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was like some kind of American thing that I didn't completely understand. Yeah. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to go with this. And I think that it was, because I remember you were once mentioning that the show is so indoors and it's so using the same sets all the time, maybe to save money. And I did end up, then I thought, oh, I'm going to watch this to see where it's set, because I was thinking about that. And I was like, oh, well, this was interesting. Like, it's set outside and there's action. And I think that that was a bit of a breather from the storyline a bit. And I was actually noting that. So that was interesting that I'm actually trying to see, you know, how the settings impact the storyline.
On that thought, though, like, there was a bit more location shooting than we've seen for a few weeks on the show. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the action scenes were really just Maya and Luca at the back of cars where it was all black outside.
Look, that's a good point. Yeah. That's actually a good point.
Kind of
so it's just
around.
Another, like, cheap way to shoot a scene.
Which also, I don't want to say that it's a cheap show. Like, it's a pricey show to make, but they're definitely cutting down costs by not having those extra extravagances.
Yeah. I don't know. Sometimes I'm like, I feel like they're just The Good Wife rehashed?
Like, in regards to what? So, I mean, what I've liked about the approach to The Good Fight is they've taken everything that was really good about The Good Wife, but they've added deeper complexity into the show with a law firm, and it's changed a bit this season, but previously the law firm didn't have as much money to play with. They weren't necessarily representing the big end of town. And also you've got people from more diverse backgrounds, largely African-American. And have we seen any other diversity except for, I think it's all just African-American. But like, that's a level of, you know, texture that you weren't seeing back in the old days of the show.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think a lot of the cases they explore are very similar.
What do you think of like the whole ripped from the headlines thing? Because I am starting to find it kind of jarring. I like the fact that, you know, we see Trump and we see Weinstein and we see like all these real players. But I think sometimes fictionalizing things can make you realize the absurdity of reality. So the art imitating life thing is interesting, but sometimes it's a bit, it feels too real. Like,
I actually like how real it feels. And I don't think they really hide away from the absurdity of it either. You had that great scene with Diane watching all the TV news services, and she's gotten a little bit higher while watching them. And so you could see the real news stories mixed in with things that were clearly slightly flights of fancy in her brain as it was going.
So you think it works?
I think it works. Yeah. And I think you can have the absurdity from human life. It doesn't necessarily need to be reflected back at you from the news stories being absurd.
Yeah.
I think people's perceptions of the news stories can be just as absurd.
Yeah, you know, maybe it's meant to be jarring. Like, it's meant to show how absurd our contemporary political landscape is, because, you know, sometimes shows are an escape. Like, you watch a show and you escape and there's all these fictional themes and they make you think about things, but because they've deliberately picked things out that are absurd from our landscape and then implanted them in a fictional show, it almost is like looking in a mirror, and it's very uncomfortable and quite intense. So maybe that's deliberate, like you said, and it is actually something that shows how absurd it is in a way that's a lot more close to home.
The thing that I think is important for us to discuss this week is how much of the episode was an homage to Hill Street Blues. So I don't know, do you know Hill Street Blues at all? Okay, every episode of Hill Street Blues used to open with a shift commander talking to all the police officers that would soon be going out on the streets to, you know, do their police work. We see The Good Fight entering the world of the police through this very deliberate construction of one of the greatest TV shows ever made, Hill Street Blues. Now, this episode, I'm sure that when they constructed this, when they were discussing it in the writer's room and found the way into the story, they just thought, you know what, this will be a very fun reference. Let's do this. It takes on slightly more weight this week, particularly for viewers who'll be watching on SBS on Wednesday night. Because between this episode being streamed in the US on Sunday, where CBS All Access stream it, you've actually had the passing of Stephen Bochco, who was the creator of Hill Street Blues.
Stephen Bochco died Sunday morning at age 74. Bochco had been battling leukemia and received a stem cell transplant from an anonymous 23-year-old in late 2014. He died peacefully in his sleep at home with his family close by.
Now, Stephen Bochco, I would actually argue, is maybe the most important TV producer of all time, because he created Hill Street Blues, which in turn actually started the development of TV as a very serious adult mode of storytelling. So prior to Hill Street Blues, you've certainly got sophisticated TV series that existed before. So I'd look to things like, say, The Twilight Zone, for example, as fairly sophisticated storytelling and production. But when you get to Hill Street Blues, what they did with that show was shifted the police show from being something where the cops had discovered something at the beginning of the episode, that investigator, that arrests someone at the end, next week it's a whole new story. Hill Street Blues really layered in a lot of interpersonal relationships, storylines that carry on from episode to episode. It constructed really what we know as modern TV today. So when the show first launched, as you'd expect, nobody watched it. It was a ratings disaster, but then the critics started talking about how good the show really was, and it still holds up today. Last night I watched a season 4 episode just to get myself in the mood of talking about Hill Street Blues, and because we'd lost Stephen Bochco. And like, the show was incredibly good. It was looking at a gay nightclub that had had a murder take place, and there was a police officer who's part of the regular crew at Hill Street Blues, and he's a gay police officer who kind of comes out saying, you know, I was there, I witnessed, and essentially it was really looking at gay nightclubs in 1981, which that's pretty progressive TV-wise. Actually, sorry, this would be 1983 because it was a season four
That's
episode.
That's huge for the time. Yeah.
And much like what The Good Fight does and so many other shows we watch now, it was kind of ripped from the headlines or ripped from mainstream culture and society and trying to elevate it and give it a bit more of a platform to be exposed to people who ordinarily wouldn't really see gay people represented anywhere. Again, this is early 80s. This was progressive television to a major degree. So you saw that show come along, which then led to shows like Saints Elsewhere coming along. And then you start hitting like the early 90s where TV started getting really deep and invested in sort of unexplored terrain. So you got things like, say, Twin Peaks and Northern Exposure, Picket Fences, ER, NYPD Blue, leads through to like The Sopranos and Oz. Like the foundations of all these shows could be found in Hill Street Blues. And so watching in this episode of The Good Fight, where they gave a very deliberate homage to Hill Street Blues with the construction of this scene, it took on so much more weight this week because with the passing of Stephen Bochco, people are actually thinking this week about what Hill Street Blues meant to television broadly. And to see a show like The Good Fight, where the DNA of the show is so heavily rooted in what they were doing in Hill Street Blues, to do an homage to that this week, of all weeks this could have happened, I just think it was amazing to watch that. So on Wednesday night, as you've watched this episode on SBS, I think maybe just sort of think about what you've seen on TV. And if you can find some clips of Hill Street Blues, I really encourage people to take a look and see what that show was. Because as is the way with TV, I'm assuming you've never watched it at all. Okay, have you ever seen clips from it? No, see, this is it. TV, once it's gone, it's kind of gone. It's pretty rare that you'd say, you know what, I'm going to go back and check out that 174-episode TV show from 1981. You're not going to do that in the same way that you might have watched, say, Citizen Kane or one of these other films that are foundational building blocks for movies. You don't do that with TV so much.
That is so interesting. You are really an encyclopedia.
I spent some time thinking about this.
It's like, and I think that really builds up the point that everything in television or everything in art and culture has to give thanks to what came before it because it builds up the ability to keep moving forward. And I think that really made me appreciate the arc that we're on when it comes to not only diversity and storytelling and what stories are being told and how that builds on the way in which other shows have changed the culture and allow those shows to actually, those future shows to exist. And I'm thinking now just about, you know, Lena Waithe's new show, which kind of built on Aziz Ansari's Master or None and how these new shows are actually, you know, it's like everything that happens in life, in politics or in art, it builds on the work of so many people that had come before it. And I think that that's, that information really like helps you see television in a kind of a light of the cultural history of a place as well.
But it's not just TV. I mean, I think everything that happens in society, quite often we'll see things and we're like, it's 2018, why do people still behave in this way? But if you contextualize it saying, well, in 2008, people were behaving that way, but to a greater extreme. And like, I certainly appreciate we live in very interesting times. Like there are Nazis back. There are Nazis back in society. And I appreciate that some Nazis never quite went away, but they weren't quite as prominent as you find them today. So there's certainly things that are being dredged to the surface. But a lot of these issues that we look at now, we're so much more enlightened when we're looking at it. I mean, I think to like a weekend ago, I was at a wedding and I had some cousins there, like gay cousins, and they were, he was openly talking about his partner in a way that he probably wouldn't have 20 years ago in that same way. So we look at the way that culture builds upon itself in the same way that TV, as we've just been discussing, builds upon itself. We get better. We sometimes fall back and sometimes TV or real life doesn't really do what we wish it was doing and it should be more progressive than where it is. But at the same time, like it's kind of, you know, five steps forward, two steps backward.
Yeah, and I
do feel positive about the world.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily that it's linear, that progress. It can be circular. Like you said,
absolutely.
Like there's just, there can be throwbacks or, you know, you have work that you see that you're like, oh, that's just like all these reboots are really annoying me. I'm like, the 90s need to stay in the 90s. Guys, you know, like when I was growing up watching it, I never thought it was problematic because I was like, oh yeah, I love Seinfeld and I love Friends and this was my world, you know. But only now I look back and I'm like, damn, that was so dated. Like it just seems so cringeworthy now. And I'm like, that needs to stay there because we live in a different world now and we need to reflect the culture that we're seeing now, not lazily rebooting stuff that needs to stay where it was because that was of its time. So that's what I find really confusing as well. I'm like, no, guys, like that's done. But Sex and the City, it was a great show. It was a great 90s show. But now it just, it's cringeworthy now.
Well, I mean, if you think about Friends, there were no black people in Friends.
Ugh.
And I think the interesting thing isn't so much that there weren't black people in Friends, but maybe the conversation surrounding that. So yeah. Back in 94 through, you know, 2002, 2003, when that show finished, a lot of the conversation was happening from critics and some culture writers saying, hey, look, there's no black people in the show. But it wasn't really a prominent part of the conversation. Whereas if that show now existed, I mean, first of all, you'd probably find a few friends of different ethnicities in the show. But that would be the huge conversation. If you've got a big show that has six white people just sitting around drinking coffee all day, like, it becomes a cultural conversation of why is there not more diversity taking place? And that's that shift that I think is happening, where you are seeing TV reflecting culture a little bit more, and people are a bit more aware and a bit more cognizant as to the problems if we just keep on repeating the same
and
stuff.
And pop culture is also a reflection of the culture and where it's at as well. So it can't really go further than what's around it, you know? And so if the conversations are more interesting or more developed, or there's more writers or there's more people in this world, then that will naturally kind of sift through to the art. So I think that now that you've seen like a generation coming of age who were born in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, whether it's migrant kids or people of color who finally are kind of getting those positions, you're going to see that kind of impacted in the art and in the television and in the work that we're seeing. So it's also just a matter of all of that kind of filtering down.
It was interesting what you were saying earlier about the good wife in this show kind of feeling the same, and it's just repeating some of the stuff. Because I think that The Good Wife originally, with its 7-season run, it didn't really have the African-American perspective on the show. But now that the show's come back in a new form, it's kind of bringing that to it. And if you look at a lot of the reboots that are happening, the successful ones are the ones that actually acknowledge the changes that have taken place within society broadly. So you look at, say, Will and Grace, which was a fairly progressive show at the time. I think it's come back now and it feels more mainstream than it ever has before.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at Roseanne, which got a lot of publicity over the last week, when you actually look at the show itself, it's actually been fairly reflective of the times that we exist in. And let's just ignore the politics of the lead star of that show entirely. But if you actually watch the show itself, it is very reflective of what's happening today. And if you look at, say, a show which I think failed and succeeded at the same time, The X-Files came back over the last 2 years.
Mm.
The bits where it actually succeeded, where they recontextualized what the show means, because the slogan for that show was always, the truth is out there. But there were a couple of episodes that explored the idea of, well, if the truth is out there, but the truth doesn't mean anything now because we deal with fake news and all that kind of gear going on, what does that show actually represent and what are they really moving towards? That stuff's all interesting. But then there's also a lot of ways they treated the Scully character in that show, which they treated her the same way in using her body really as a way of pushing stories through. There was a lot of conversations about her being raped and impregnated. There was some really gross, icky stuff. And that stuff kind of worked back in 1995. But when you tried doing that in 2018, man, did that show feel just incredibly dated. And viewers, I think, rejected that quite heavily. There's a lot of discussion against the show.
Yeah, look, I think that it's just a disservice to these shows, because you grow up loving these shows and you have such a nostalgia for them. And it's just dragged them kicking and screaming into a world or a place that they don't belong and ruins it for us.
This probably brings us to the end of another Good Fight podcast for the week. The Good Fight airs every Wednesday night in Australia on SBS at 9:40. You can stream episodes after they air at SBS On Demand. Sarah, it has been a pleasure doing the podcast with you again this week. You're on Twitter. How can people get in contact with you?
So I'm at Sarah B. Malik. So yeah, please hit us up online and let us know what you think, and look forward to continuing the conversation.
Indeed. People can find me at The Dan Barrett. Also, you can tweet us at SBS TV. If you're going to get on Twitter or Facebook or whatever your social media of choice is, use that hashtag GoodFightSBS. Also, if you've enjoyed this podcast, you may enjoy some of the other SBS podcasts we're doing for broad pop culture, with interviews behind some of the talent behind your favourite movies and TV shows of the moment. Check out the playlist hosted by our friends Fiona Williams and Nick Bassine. Also, if you like the old 1960s Batman TV show, I'm doing a podcast talking about that as well. It's called Batman Land, and we're midway through season 2 of talking about that show. Tune in, that can be a lot of fun. Anyway, guys, this has been the end of the Good Fight SBS fan podcast. We'll be back again next week. And as they used to say on Hill Street Blues, be careful out there.
Hey, let's be careful out there.
Bye.
The This podcast and its contents are not endorsed or sponsored by CBS Studios Incorporated or The Good Fight.